Fish Radio. Stay with us.
I need Annie.
That'll change in time.
Time does not exist here. And wherever it went, it's not going to make me need Annie any less.
Or would you journey beyond heaven and hell?
You never see her.
I'm her soulmate. I can find her.
To get it back.
All you're good for is your wife loves you.
You just kept me there.
Robin Williams.
It's about not giving up.
Cuba Gooding Jr.
He's never been anywhere like this before.
Well, neither have you.
I'm not leaving him.
Annabella Sciorra.
Across whatever distance there is, I send you my love.
She's fine. You can do it. I believe in you.
I'm still here, babe. I still exist.
What dreams may come.
Welcome back to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio. My guest speakers are still Syed Abdullah and Brother Yasser. In the studio, helping me criticize the movie What Dreams May Come, produced in 1998, directed by Vincent Ward. Well, Brother Yasser, how does this movie, What Dreams May Come, explore the concept of soulmates? We do hear a lot of notions and concepts such as soulmates today, in the kind of spiritualism, which is, you know, becoming so widespread nowadays, right?
Look, there are certain ahadith, I can't remember reading them a long time ago, that indicate something like this. There is something like this, and I can't exactly remember the ahadith right now off the top of my head, and traditions, any prophetic traditions.
Yes.
But if you also look at it in a means of God's knowledge, but again, this is a very, very, very intricate discussion. We don't want to enter it, for example. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has knowledge of everything that is going to happen, you'll only marry that person that you were meant to marry.
Right.
At the end of the day, right? That's going to happen.
Yes.
Again, it's not to say that it's fate or fatalism and stuff. Everything is based on your own free will.
Yes.
The very important concept of al-amr bayn al-amrain, or the...
The middle
path, right, between the two extremes
of
complete fatalism and complete free will. So that in mind, and keeping that in mind, the concept of soulmates can be understood to a certain level. For example, in the Shi'i tradition, we believe that Imam Ali alayhi salam and Hazrat Zahra salam alayhi were soulmates. We believe that.
Yes.
We believe that. But again, it has to be understood in not in just a love that or a soulmate that is based on physical ideals or and ideals based on the physical realm. No, these are ideals based on higher ideals, you know, on truth, on justice, on love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and so on and so forth.
Right.
So the concept can be explained, but obviously the criteria and the definition needs to be very carefully depicted and produced.
Thank you. Syed Abdullah, how does this movie portray grief or loss and its impact or their impacts on individuals?
Well, it depends from one person to another. For example, we see that the man was able to handle certain pressures that the woman could not handle. So there is this difference between people and how
and
much
their capacity
and the capacity and how much they know and how much they view things. So, for example, the guy was a doctor, so he's used to people dying. He's used to see people dying. It's just part of his daily life. And even the way he died, he was just trying to save someone from death. So I think he was more receptive to accepting loss than the woman herself, because a woman being emotional, she lost her kids and now she lost her husband. She had nothing to live for. And therefore, you see, she took her life. So it depends on each one's capacity, grief will play. So it's not the same. And even the scene in hell as well, obviously different people were dealing with different issues and based on that. In heaven, he met the lady that was wearing blue. Also, she had she was in heaven, but she had a sense of loss when she was talking about hell life. So from one person to another, it's not the same. There is no one cut for all in terms of laws. And as things happens and applies to us as well, sometimes when we lose someone, our family member, one of our family members could lose it completely, and some people will be like, it's life. That's me. I'm the one that's going to say, hey, it's life. And everyone hates me for that.
Yeah.
Like, you are hard-headed. You are emotional. I'm like, call me whatever you like.
Okay, thank you very much, Said Abdullah and Brother Yasser, for your nice contribution or interesting viewpoints. In the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, in which we try to criticize the movie What Dreams May Come, produced in 1998, directed by Winston Ward. Of course, we haven't finished the critique of this movie, and hopefully we'll do that in the upcoming episode. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Good morning to you all. Greetings from Tehran. You are listening to Iran Radio. I'm your presenter for the next hour. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Many academic traditions, including the distinction between graduates and undergraduates, began at Islamic University Al-Azhar, the resplendent university in Cairo, Egypt. The university was founded in the 10th century and is renowned for its philosophical and theoretical scholarship. Algebra, from the Arabic al-jabr, originated in the Islamic world. Although Muslims are often associated with the Arab world, fewer than 15% of Muslims are Arabs. Muslims are found among virtually all ethnic groups, nationalities, and countries. We start this hour's lineup with Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about current events and issues in the West Asia region. They will be followed by our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories. And we round up this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Thank you for joining us. Netanyahu's request for a pardon from Herzog, the escalation of aggression against Lebanon, the advanced missile that failed to explode in the latest Israeli attack on Beirut southern suburbs, as well as the repercussions of the Beitian confrontations in the Damascus countryside, were among the topics addressed in Hebrew media. And we discuss them today with Ms. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator of Samedon Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you.
After the confrontations between the residents of Beijing in the countryside of the Syrian capital, Damascus, and the Israeli occupation forces, U.S. President Donald Trump moved to calm the situation and restore negotiations between the administration of Netanyahu and al-Julani's regime. Charles, do you feel that Israel is undermining Trump's administration's strategy in Syria?
Well, I think it's a question about whether it's undermining the strategy or whether what we're looking at is essentially a carrot and the stick type of joint attack that's designed to lead to the same goal, which is a Syria that is subservient to and acting solely in the interests of the United States and the Zionist regime, which, of course, acts as the leading agent for U.S. interest and U.S. domination and imperialism in the region. And so on the one hand, you have, you know, the U.S. claiming to suddenly be interested in a prosperous Syria after it has done nothing but spent the past 15 years attempting to destroy and dismantle Syria and subjected it to unlawful and illegal unilateral course of measures in order to destroy the Syrian economy. So there's a certain ridiculousness to the U.S. talking about a prosperous Syria to begin with. But the other side of that is, and saying, oh, we want you to engage in official normalization with the Zionist regime, which is going to be a very hard sell to the Syrian people, regardless of the willingness of the Syrian government to act as, you know, agents or interlocutors for the United States.
Yeah, however, United States wants to communicate Turkey inside Syria, and that's the major difference between American interests and Israeli interests.
Well, because the U.S. sees Turkey as a partner in NATO, whereas the Zionist regime solely sees Turkey as a rival, mainly sees Turkey as a rival, as a regional power in the region, and they want to maintain kind of sole domination, not just be one of several regional powers.
Okay, so therefore there is a disagreement. They're not both agreeing on the same aspects.
I wouldn't call it a disagreement. If it were a disagreement, we would see the United States, it's a mild rivalry between two imperial clients, that and the United States benefits from it, doesn't lose because of it. The United States doesn't lose because of this. On the contrary, if the U.S. wanted the Zionists to stop attacking Syria, they would at least behind the scenes, demand that they stop attacking Syria and using U.S. weapons to do it. But the fact is, every day when the Zionists are carrying out incursions and a full-on occupation of southern Syria, mm-hmm. they're doing that with U.S. weapons and U.S. intelligence.
Okay, but how will the establishment of an American military base inside Syria and, as the report highlighted, impact Israelis' actions in Syria?
Essentially, the State of Israel, so-called State of Israel, is the largest U.S. military base in the region. So the idea that they will determine together the United States and its, you know, its partner slash colonial project
yes.
will determine together how best to split up control of Syria for selling it to the Syrian people and attempting to sell it to the world, because the U.S. is also concerned about the level of resistance they're going to face. They want to market themselves as a partner to the new Syria after being very visibly an agent of its destruction for the past 15 years. Well, it's really hard to do that if they're visibly showing their support for the full-on occupation and colonization of southern Syria. But, you know, we saw that the last time that Trump was in office,
yes.
he declared that he was giving the Golan Heights, already occupied Syrian territory, to the Zionist entity, and they established a new settlement there called the Trump Zone. So, you know, there's clearly not really a fundamental contradiction here, but simply a pincher approach where Syria, and not necessarily this Syrian government, but the Syrian people are being caught between the U.S. and its normalization approach on the one hand, and its normalization approach is based not on normalization with the U.S., which has already been accomplished, but normalization with the Zionist right. entity, and the harsh stick of the Zionist actually coming, bombing, mm-hmm. kidnapping, abducting, and killing.
Okay, and now to Lebanon and the stances announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem regarding the response to the assassination of the martyr Tabtabai. Latest updates on the Lebanese stance, the talks of President Joseph Hond of sending a civilian to engage in the talks and negotiations, take part in the mechanism, and also Netanyahu is doing the same, sending an envoy. How do you see this?
Well, there's always this push. The idea that there should be direct negotiations rather than indirect negotiations, which is, you know, what currently exists, is something that the United States is trying to do, because just like we're seeing in Syria, the United States wants to put Lebanon on a course to normalization with the Zionist regime, and they're determined to attempt to achieve this goal. And if they don't achieve this goal the way they've been trying to do it, which has basically been through attempting to foment a civil war, attempting to engage in these ongoing ceasefire violations on a daily basis, demanding that Lebanon change its entire economy and financial rules in order to benefit the United States, demanding that that Lebanon essentially engage in home searches of mm-hmm. its own citizens' homes for the interests of the United States, trying to impose U.S. sanctions inside the Lebanese economy, and that's being tied together with the ongoing attacks by, you know, U.S. weaponry by the Zionists.
But all these steps are taken prior to Artago's visit to Lebanon.
Yes.
Do you think they're trying to maintain the situation before her arrival? Because as you're highlighting, it is said that she has a lot of these points on her list, which is that most of the Lebanese in Al-Bika Valley will not accept.
Right. And I mean, there's no reason why Lebanon or any sovereign state should ever accept any of these demands by the United States. I mean, if there's any real interest in the concept of sovereignty, which is, you know, frequently deployed by, unfortunately, many people who advocate for the acceptance of the U.S.'s demands, you can't have sovereignty and a foreign entity demanding control of your economy, your lives, and your houses. And so there's mm-hmm. a clear contradiction here, and it's frustrating the Zionists, frankly, that the Lebanese president isn't willing to engage in a civil war in
yes.
Lebanon
yes.
in order
and
to benefit Zionism and imperialism.
Okay, do these Israeli comments that we just heard show that Hezbollah is still navigating the situation in Lebanon?
Well, I mean, Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance are absolutely still living, growing, representing a huge sector of the Lebanese population, holding on to their land. The fact is that despite these ongoing and horrific ceasefire violations by the Zionist regime, the the Zionists were not able to achieve any gains of territory, any control of land, any occupation of Lebanon by force of arms. The Lebanese resistance consistently and thoroughly repelled them and rejected them and fought them off. It's only been through the fact that Hezbollah does care very deeply about the future of Lebanon and about its people that it's has so far restrained itself, instead calling on the state to take the matters that are necessary to bring these ceasefire violations to an end. Mm-hmm. But it's clear, and it's been clear and has remained clear, that all of these claims by the Zionists and the U.S. that, you know, Hezbollah is defeated or dead are nothing but complete lies and fabrications. And now this is, they really, as was, you know, shown by these comments, mm-hmm. they are stuck admitting this as well. So now all of their, you know, hope for destruction has kind of run up on the fact that most Lebanese are not interested in seeing their resistance destroyed and turning themselves over to the Zionist regime.
Okay. Staying in Lebanon and the issue of the very advanced American missile used by the Israeli occupation in its latest aggression in Beirut's southern suburbs in the crime of assassinating the martyr Tabtabai. How serious of a concern is this to the United States and Israel?
Well, I mean, I just want to say that it's absolutely absurd and outrageous for them to engage in an offensive attack and a bombing of another country, assassinating people in the middle of a neighborhood, and then declare at a very crowded residential neighborhood in an apartment over buildings and businesses and people going about their lives, mm-hmm. and then say that they're angry that the bomb didn't explode, and not just that, but that they want it back. I mean, it's an absolute that you know, our bomb didn't succeed in killing as
what
many
are
of
they
you
scared
as they hoped,
what
so
are
give
they
it back to
of?
Us.
Exactly.
Well, anyway, I mean, they're clearly afraid because the fact is that they know that Hezbollah and the resistance as a whole has tremendous technological capabilities, intelligence capabilities.
But obviously,
it is
this
more than
one
capable
is
of reverse engineering.
Yeah, but this
thing.
One also is a sophisticated one.
Yes, but they know that the resistance is able to reverse engineer it too. Okay. If it's in the hands of the resistance, they'll be able to understand how it works. If they understand how it works, its components, they might be able to redirect it, stop it, and really
create similar ones to it.
Create similar ones to it to put it into use and to blunt its effectiveness as a tool of aerial weaponry.
And they also said that they're scared that it will be sent to China and Russia and that they will be aware of its own details.
Yeah, I mean, well, the reason why you have the U.S. involved in all of this is because the Zionist arsenal and the U.S. arsenal are so deeply combined mm-hmm. that essentially the U.S. is concerned about its, you know, whatever advantages it has militarily against China and Russia sort of being compromised by the fact that this bomb did not explode.
Okay. And to the Israeli escalation in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria, which according to the Zionists aims to prevent enemies from restoring their military capabilities. Is Israel in dilemma now where it faces the pressure of launching a risky multi-front war, or the fact that they should minimize the military capabilities of their own enemies? How do you see this?
Well, you know, the Zionist entity is, of course, it's an expansionist project. It's constantly trying to steal more land, to occupy more area, to force more people from their homes. I mean, every day we're seeing them carry out attacks in the West Bank. We're seeing them attacking Syria. We're seeing them constantly violating the ceasefire in Lebanon, constantly violating the ceasefire in Gaza, you know, killing people on a daily basis. And they don't want to be held accountable for this fact. They don't want to be held accountable even for corruption charges within their own system, like Netanyahu. And they're, you know, essentially using the fact that they want to engage in this attack and speaking about that as if that's normal, as if, you know, in constantly engaging in offensive warfare against your neighbors mm-hmm. is a normal part. But it's only normal if you're an illegitimate settler colonial entity that's implanted in the region that's based on just constant war expansion and domination. And so it should always be seen as a threat.
Do you think that Netanyahu's pardon is because of this situation where they are stuck between two decisions, major dilemma?
I mean, the fact is that Netanyahu, for his own personal interest, has constantly pursued the most aggressive option, the most expansionist option, more warfare and more attacks, essentially in part as an endless way of postponing his own corruption trial, which has been postponed for years and years and years on end at this point. So there is a connection between these two things, but it's certainly not because, you know, Netanyahu is a great military tactician and theoretician who wants to spend his time, you know, contemplating the military issues. It's because he constantly uses actually ceasefire violations carried out by the Zionist regime and the killing of Palestinians and Syrians and Lebanese and Yemenis and Iranians as a reason to escape his own corruption trial.
Okay. The pardon request submitted by Netanyahu to Herzog regarding the charges against him in the corruption cases remain the center of heated debate in both the political and media arenas in the Israeli entity, as voices rose between those welcoming and those opposing it. In your opinion, will granting Netanyahu pardon face serious opposition that could actually lead to legally obstruct his own request?
Well, there's certainly going to be serious opposition, particularly if it's granted without conditions. I mean, there's been some discussion about imposing some kind of, oh, you must retire from political life if you're granted the pardon. But the fact is that Netanyahu has been on and off prime minister of the Zionist regime repeatedly for over 25 years at this point. So the idea that if he, you know, resigns for a few months and then comes back, it's going to be the end of Netanyahu is obviously not the case. The fact is that the Zionist entity is showing that it's actually perfectly fine with corruption at the highest levels among its leadership and as long as it's able to maintain this relationship with the United States and its domination and military control of the region. And it's willing to do so, and it's willing to engage in kind of the politics of pardon and anti-corruption.
So he still gains the domestic support, Charlotte? He still gains domestic support?
I mean,
when he's facing corruption trials?
He's lost a lot of domestic support, but a lot of that has had... One of the biggest reasons he's lost domestic support in many cases is that, you know, every time there's been a successful resistance operation, Netanyahu loses support because the Zionist public gets angry at, like, a quote-unquote lack of security because of the fact that they view Netanyahu as pursuing this policy of war and destruction and maximizing conflict in order to essentially postpone or prevent any
But here the Israeli
himself.
Commentator said that by requesting pardon, Netanyahu does not lose politically, but rather gains politically. How do you interpret this?
Well, I mean, he can gain politically from among his supporters. They're also, if the pardon comes about, then it removes this issue of Netanyahu's pending corruption charges from the political agenda of the Zionist opposition. And so it becomes like one less weapon that the opposition has. At the same time, the opposition is certainly going to escalate and may strongly oppose this pardon request. You know, we'll see what's going to happen. There is no unity within the Zionist project except that unity that exists against Palestinians and against Arabs and against the people of the region. I mean, frankly, Netanyahu is also wanted for war crimes and before the International Criminal Court. It's not just a matter of his corruption inside the Zionist regime. Those are the smallest of Netanyahu's crimes.
But Donald Trump made it very clear in a press conference that the Israelis should not push Netanyahu towards these trials. They should forgive him for that.
Well, you know, Trump and Netanyahu both have a history of corruption charges, financial gain from political office, charges. And so Trump, to a certain extent, even as an individual, identifies with Netanyahu based on this policy of carrying out wars, carrying out attacks, essentially in order to distract from their own legal issues and essentially using the lives of people in the global south as a plaything for their own corruption charges and, you know, financial crimes within office.
Okay. Now, however, Israeli social media commentators, meanwhile, expressed strong opposition to Netanyahu's and the entity's president, Herzog, as we will see together.
Gilan Aria, what will happen to President Isaac Herzog? What a paid puppet president you are. Netanyahu is corrupt and rotten, destroyed Israel, caused the deaths of 1,400 Israelis and the kidnapping of 251 others in a single day, and abandoned them. Merav Cohen, as soon as Netanyahu requested a pardon, the campaign demanding the dismissal of the Attorney General retreated because it was merely a tool, and the objective was, and still is, the annulment of Netanyahu's trial. Naama Butler, Netanyahu is guilty and a liar, as during his trial he repeatedly fell into the trap of lies.
Our time is up, Ms. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator of Samedon Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network. It was very nice having you with us today.
Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Bazaar.
The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion.
Hello everyone, Ali Reza here, welcoming you to a brand new edition of Bazaar. This week, we are taking you on a journey through Iran's mammoth building construction industry while highlighting some of the country's recent developments in this sector. Plus, we will check out its market as a whole and the construction industry's contributions to the national economy. So, let's get started.
To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands.
All things considered, the construction sector has been significant for the Iranian economy. The sector is divided into two main parts: government infrastructure projects and the housing industry. The construction industry has been thriving due to national and international investment to the extent that it is now one of the largest in the West Asia region.
This sector suffered a lot after the U.S. withdrew from the 2015 deal and reimposed sanctions against Iran. These measures choked construction materials imports. As a result, the steady flow of things like metals to Iran was seriously hampered and eventually halted altogether. But despite the bans, this industry continues to grow and is also one of the few that exports services to other countries. Based on the Association of Iranian Exports of Technical and Engineering Services, Iran currently has the potential to export engineering services worth $40 billion annually. The country already exports these services to countries around the Caspian Sea, its bordering neighbors, South and Central America, North Africa, and South Asia. Some construction projects include sewage treatment plants, dams, and energy plants. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran is self-sufficient in construction material production. Steel, glass, and cement are abundantly produced in the country. Moreover, the surplus of these items is exported to countries worldwide. Government officials say they have plans to expand exports to Iran's trade partners, including China and Russia. For example, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade says it plans to sell upwards of $3 billion worth of construction materials to Russia alone. As a whole, the government views the construction sector as a feasible alternative for generating foreign revenues and diversifying the country's economy away from oil profits. That wraps up our program for today. Also, if you have a topic that you're interested in, you can send us your thoughts and suggestions via email. We always enjoy hearing from you. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in. Until then, take care and bye-bye.
searching for the light, and you see no hope in sight. Be sure and have no doubt, he is always close to you. He's the one who knows you best, he knows what's in your heart. You'll find your peace at last if you just have faith in him. You're always in my heart and mind. Your name is mentioned every day. I follow you no matter what. My biggest wish is to see you one day.
Till the end of time, a creature could be compared with him. So full of life and blessings, you're always in my heart and mind. Your name is mentioned every day. I'll follow you no matter what. God wills you meet one day.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, be sensible. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on IRIB English Radio with my sister Zainab and you. So be sensible. Be sensible in a sense as different sorts of connotations. So one meaning of be sensible is, don't be silly. Don't act in such a sort of silly way or sort of a crazy way. Be sensible, behave yourself. So that's not quite the way I mean it. So being sensible can also be using common sense, not being, for example, extravagant, being really practical, down to earth. So that's the sort of particular meaning I'm talking about today. And I'll give you just an example from life of one of the famous martyrs of the Holy Defense, Seijan Bozorgi. So, for example, he was very practical, very common sense, also with the way he would sort of use clothes and what sort of clothes he would wear for certain occasions. For example, he didn't want to accept his father-in-law buying him a special suit for his wedding proposal ceremony, because basically he said, well, I'm only going to be wearing that suit once. So his idea was that he would just wear trousers and a jacket, and of course he would launder them so they looked really good and so special and nicely pressed. You know, this is this is an attitude that, you know, all our martyrs have. If you read a bit more about their lives, they were all not wanting to sort of create extra fuss or be extravagant. They're all very practical, common sense, down to earth, and certainly not wasteful or extravagant. Nowadays, look, for sure, many of us have maybe, we stray a bit from that when we walk past all the different shop fronts these days, whatever country we're in. You know, we see extravagant dresses that women can wear to go to parties or even just for family functions. We're supposed to wear really special things the whole time when we're not on the street. But I'll talk about this a bit more. Welcome back to A to Z here on IIB English Radio with my sister Dana. So I'm talking about this actually quite nice trait of being sensible, being practical, being common sense, being down to earth, being, in a sense, modest and humble. You know, it's something that Islam wants us to be, wants to encourage in us. And, you know, I don't know if nowadays that many of us are really sticking to that guideline. You know, we're really good in our worship, so we maybe even pray on time and we fast and, you know, we give in charity. But are we really observing some of these other recommendations, such as just not being extravagant? And, you know, it's difficult because, look, when we're surrounded by many people in society who want to, let's say, be very special. And I'll just sort of talk about this. And this applies to societies in Muslim-majority countries. This applies also to our Islamic communities in Western countries, for example. When we go to, let's say, get-togethers of, you know, just some of the women, friends or family members, or when we go to some of the weddings, when we go to, like, bigger gatherings, are we indeed just that modest and practical and common sense, or do we have a tendency to sort of start putting on the most amazing outfits, you know, glittery, shiny outfits, and pile on all the jewelry and pile on, you know, whatever makeup as well? Obviously, I'm talking about the women, because for the men, I can't quite comment on the men, but this is especially for the women, because, you know, women, we can see it in our societies. Women are offered so many options in terms of dress. So is this really necessary that we always need to behave like that? That just because other people are sort of going overboard and doing the opposite of being practical and sensible, that we need to be like that too? And, you know, this is something I talk about quite a bit. And, you know, and where's the limit? Where does it stop? So this is just a reminder for all of us, and especially to us women. Is it necessary? What has happened to our modesty and humility? So, inshallah, this is a reminder for all of us, especially as women, to take stock. And, look, I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z, and farewell for today. Thank you. thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
That was the week that was.
Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shape the past 7 days, from the heart of region to the global stage. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshande. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about Donald Trump banning South Africa from G20 summit over alleged human rights abuse. President Trump has banned South Africa from attending next year's G20 summit for what he characterizes as human rights abuses leading to the slaughter of white people. The United States did not attend the G20 summit in South Africa because the South African government refuses to acknowledge or address the horrific human rights abuses endured by Afrikaners and other descendants of Dutch, French, and German settlers. President Trump wrote on social media, "Therefore, at my direction, South Africa will not be receiving an invitation to the 2026 G20 meeting, which will be hosted in the great city of Miami, Florida next year." The Trump administration has long accused the South African government of allowing minority white Afrikaner farmers to be persecuted and attacked, as it restricted the number of refugees admitted annually to the U.S. to 7,500. The administration indicated that most will be white South Africans who it claimed faced discrimination and violence at home. But the government of South Africa has said it is surprised by the accusation of discrimination because white people in the country generally have a much higher standard of living than its black residents. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Miranda Akhshande.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, has there been a genocide of white South Africans as Donald Trump has claimed?
Well, actually, none of South Africa's political parties, including those that represent Afrikaners or the white community in South Africa, have claimed that there is currently a genocide going on in South Africa. In fact, President Trump's claim was described as nonsense by John Steenhuisen, the leader of South Africa's second biggest political party, the Democratic Alliance. And Steenhuisen is also the Minister of Agriculture in the coalition government led by President Cyril Ramaphosa. And also, Jacob Kleinhans, a senior official in the Africana lobby group Solidarity, said he has told the American government that there is no genocide in South Africa and there is no government seizure of land belonging to white South Africans. So, unfortunately, such claims have been circulating among right-wing or extreme right-wing groups for many years now. And even in his first term in office, President Trump referred to the large-scale killing of white farmers in South Africa, and that was in his first term in office.
Yeah.
So some white farmers actually have been killed in South Africa. South Africa does have a very high murder rate.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of misleading information about this on the internet. In February of this year, a South African judge dismissed the idea of a genocide as clearly imagined and not real when ruling in an inheritance case involving a wealthy benefactor's donation to white supremacist group, the Boer Legion.
Right.
South Africa does not release crime figures based on race, but in May of this year, South Africa's police minister, Senzo Mchunu, gave a breakdown of killings on farms in South Africa in order to debunk claims about genocide in the country.
Yeah.
So the South African police minister, Senzo Mchunu, said between January and March of this year, 5 out of 6 people killed on farms in South Africa were black, and just one of them was white.
Right.
The white victim lived on a farm, while the black people who were killed comprised of 2 farm owners, 2 employees, and 1 farm manager. So I can say that claims of a white genocide in South Africa have been repeatedly dismissed by the South African government and South African officials, by independent judges and international media, and these claims have been dismissed as either imaginary or not real. So the South African government has totally rejected Donald Trump's claim of a genocide in the country.
Yeah. Donald Trump and Elon Musk said about discrimination and genocide in South Africa?
Well, Donald Trump, first of all, he defended his decision of giving Afrikaners refugee status.
Right.
Trump said a genocide was taking place in South Africa. White farmers were being brutally killed, in his words, and their land was being confiscated, in his words. But South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, actually visited the White House, visited Washington.
Right, yeah.
In May of this year, he met with President Trump at the White House, and he said it is completely false. Cyril Ramaphosa said it is completely false to claim that people of a certain race or culture are being targeted for persecution in his country.
Yeah.
Cyril Ramaphosa also referred to a group of white South Africans who have obtained a visa because the United States is giving them preferential treatment. White South Africans are being given visas quite easily by the federal government in the United States. President Ramaphosa said these white South Africans are leaving the country because they don't want to embrace the changes that are currently taking place in our country and in South Africa's constitution. So President Ramaphosa, who was in the White House in May of this year, he was kind of taken by surprise.